Welcome to Wise at Work, the podcast exploring the intersection of science, culture, and meaning in the workplace. I'm Corey Smith, the CEO of Wisdom Labs, and your host. In this episode, Wisdom Labs' Meghna Majmudar talks with Dr. Parneet Pal. Parneet is a Harvard and Columbia-trained physician on a mission to scale the ideas that make well-being easy and accessible to all using evidence-based medicine and innovative behavior change models. She made a shift from clinical practice to prevention, focusing on the execution of wellness programs in various business and academic settings. She has directed two wellness spas and expanded a private executive health practice, and currently coaches executives and consults with organizations on the design and implementation of lifestyle management platforms. Parneet is the Chief Science Officer at Wisdom Labs. And now, Parneet Pal, interviewed by Meghna Majmudar.
So I want to dive in. One of the things I find really interesting about your background, you are a doctor that focuses on lifestyle medicine. And so I think whenever I've introduced you to people, they ask, what is lifestyle medicine? And would love to hear your thoughts on that and why you chose that type of focus.
When we look at people around us, whether that's people around us in our families or people that we work with, three out of four of us are going to suffer from a lifestyle-related chronic disease in our lifetimes. That's things like heart disease, obesity, diabetes, cancer, anxiety, depression. And this accounts for 86% of our healthcare costs in the U.S. And what's worse is that it's not an epidemic that's restricted to North America. It's now becoming a global issue. So when I was finishing up my medical residency and I came across this statistic, it was truly stunning to me. And I realized that a lot of my training was focused on treating people when they were really, really sick, and nobody was really talking about prevention and how to help people stay well. And I found myself drawn towards that end of the spectrum more and more. But there was another study that came out many years ago. It was an epic study, and the results were so encouraging. It showed that 80 to 90% of these lifestyle-related chronic diseases are completely preventable. So I'll say that again. They're completely preventable.
Completely.
Completely. When we pay attention to just a few things, you know, what we eat, how much we move, how we sleep, and how we manage our stress and our emotions. And that became sort of a North Star, if you will, in how I planned my career after residency. I became very interested in this idea of wanting to help people stay well. And what I found out was that there is this new movement now, the lifestyle medicine movement. More and more physicians are taking an interest in what we consider will be the future of healthcare, not just in the US, but globally. This focus on helping people optimize not just their lifespan. So obviously we want to help people live longer, but also optimizing their health span, which is the quality of the years that they have using their lifestyle well.
Mm-hmm. And so what's the difference between lifestyle medicine and public health?
That's a good question. So lifestyle medicine definitely impacts public health. And when we look at the, for example, the statistics that I just mentioned, obviously, when you look at huge populations, you want society to be healthier. Lifestyle medicine can be practiced in a very clinical setting. So you might be able to go to your primary care physician who has taken an interest in lifestyle medicine and will be able to give you very specific advice on nutrition and stress management and exercise and so on. More and more healthcare practices are now incorporating health coaches into the mix to help you with this as well. But then in organizations and businesses, this is becoming increasingly important as well. So when you think about the impact of these chronic diseases to a business, the cost of stress itself on business is upwards of $300 billion in the US. And as I mentioned before, especially if you're a self-insured employer, the impact that somebody is suffering from any of these diseases because they require long-term care is huge. And it's huge not just in terms of them falling sick and not showing up for work, but also in terms of how focused they are, how energetic do they feel, how productive do they feel, how connected do they feel to their work. In other words, it impacts their engagement as well.
Mm-hmm. So you're starting to talk about why lifestyle medicine is important in the business environment. You know, sometimes, you know, when I think about when I've worked at big companies and they have these wellness programs and, you know, if I do certain things, then I can get some percentage off my healthcare coverage. It's a little uncomfortable for me. So why are you so excited about applying lifestyle medicine in the business world?
So there's a difference between having a wellness program and having a wellness program that works well. What we are learning now is that, you know, there's a statistic that the return on investment of every dollar invested in a wellness program is close to anywhere between $3 to $5 back. There's been a lot of debate recently as to whether or not that is true. And I think the key piece there is to realize and to understand that a wellness program cannot be successful in a vacuum. And this is where, and you know, this is our philosophy at Wisdom Labs as well, is that when we create any kind of well-being program, how can you embed that into the culture of an organization? How can you apply the principles of behavior change? Because all of us, Meghna, I'm sure you as well, right, in your personal life, we all know that we need to eat a certain way, or there's a certain amount of exercise that we need to do, or we need to sleep well, and so on. But it's really hard to do that, right? Life gets in the way and stress gets in the way. And so I think for a well-being program at work to be successful, its implementation has to really keep the principles of behavior change in mind and make it really easy for folks to reach for the healthier choice. So in other words, make the healthier choice the easiest option around them.
So one of the terms I've heard you use, and I don't know quite what it means, but it sounds really cool, is this idea of epigenetics and yes. Epigenetics of the workplace. Can you tell me more about that?
Yes, of course. So epigenetics, again, is a relatively new field in health and medicine. And it literally, the word itself, epigenetics, means over or above genetics. So here's a way to think about it. So everybody knows that we have genes, you know, the DNA that we inherit from our parents. All of our cells have that same copy of the DNA, and that doesn't change. But if you think about, you know, why does your liver cell look like a liver cell? And why does your brain cell look like a brain cell, even though they have that same DNA? That doesn't make sense, right? So what's cool is that over this genetic code, there are certain tags, if you will. You know, there are certain tags that appear on our DNA, and they have the ability to, and this is a very simplistic explanation, to turn certain parts of the genes on and off. And that instructs the cell whether or not it needs to make a certain kind of protein. So, for example, your liver cell will have a particular tag that says, go produce these kind of proteins that will make you a liver cell and not a brain cell. And there will be a different kind of tagging system for your brain cell and so on. So this is a wonderful system that we have in place. And over the years, what scientists began to notice is that it's not simply a matter of differentiating different kinds of cells, but the environment that we expose ourselves to. So the food that we eat, the air that we breathe, the amounts of stress that we have in our lives, that influences these tags as well. In effect, our lifestyle has the ability to turn certain genes on and off throughout our life. And this has many implications. And one of them is that it's a good thing. It's very empowering. This means that we can use our lifestyle even if we've inherited certain risk factors. Our DNA is not our destiny. So to a certain extent, we have some control over which genes will express themselves versus not. And this is useful when it comes to modification of disease risk. So lifestyle-wise, we know that exercise works in certain ways because it turns certain proteins on and off in our muscle cells and liver cells. But closer to home, you know, there's been a whole set of experimentation on how our minds influence this sort of on and off and the inflammation in our body. So Dr. Steve Cole, who is an amazing scientist. He's the head of the Social Genomics Lab at UCLA, and we've collaborated with him on some of our projects. He's a pioneer in a line of study that looks at this kind of gene expression. So he's looked at folks, he's done animal studies and human studies, taking a look at the effects of stress and adversity on gene expression. And what he's found is that there are a certain set of genes that express themselves in a certain way when we're exposed to, for example, loneliness, or when we feel isolated, or when we feel chronically stressed. And the technical term is the conserved transcriptional response to adversity, or CTRA. And what happens is that when our bodies are exposed to, say, I had a very traumatic childhood, or even as an adult, I'm working in a system where I'm feeling very isolated, this communicates with my cells, especially my immune cells, my white blood cells, in such a way that the tags that code for inflammation turn on more than usual, and the ones that tag for immunity turn off. In other words, my body becomes more and more inflamed, and I become less immune when I'm in this lonely, isolated state of mind, which means, of course, that I'm going to fall sick more often.
Yeah, so I just want to pause here because this is huge. Because when I think about how much time people spend at work and what that means in terms of gene expression, I think until this moment, absolutely, I just thought, oh, all this gene expression stuff, it's what happens at home, but it's actually happening all the time at work. And so if you are feeling lonely at work, or if it's super stressful at work without stop, this is what's going to lead to that illness in 10 to 20 years.
Absolutely. And I'm so glad that you emphasize that, Meghna, because I think we just don't realize this, right? And just to point out that it's actually affecting us right now. It's not even going to take 10 to 20 years. Unfortunately, the effects are pretty immediate. But the flip side and the good side is that when we pay attention to that, when we start becoming more mindful of the fact that this is happening, the more awareness that we build into how we live our lives, we can reverse the process. So it's not a one-way street. And if we can start to address the causes of that loneliness or the causes of the stress at work, the inflammation can go down and the immunity can go up. In fact, Dr. Cole's studies, and there have been other researchers as well who've shown that practices like meditation and mindfulness have this ability to reverse that trend. Another interesting fact along those lines around gene expression and inflammation is that a lot of the previous research has looked at this in sort of very protected retreat environments. And at Wisdom Labs, we actually took it to the workplace and we collaborated with Dr. Steve Cole and did a 12-week observational pilot study. And we looked at this gene expression. So yes, we took blood from these folks at an advertising agency. And we put them through a 12-week mindfulness program where they met once a week for an hour and learned about mindfulness. We sent them home with a companion app to practice throughout the week. We taught them about behavior change and how that works. And then we looked at their blood gene expression before and after the 12 weeks. And we were really happy to find that there was a statistically significant move in the healthy direction of their gene expression. In other words, they had lower levels of inflammation and better levels of immunity after the 12 weeks of that mindfulness program. And in the scales that we measure, the self-reported scales on loneliness, they reported feeling more connected with their colleagues.
What you just shared about stress and loneliness and its impact on our genes is so powerful. And I feel it is the lay of the land when it comes to work. So how do we even begin to address this and change this so that people have some sort of a chance to live that fun and fulfilling life that they want?
One of the things to consider is just how behavior change works. Why as human beings do we do the things that we do? And why don't we do the things that are important to us?
Or that we know are good for us.
Exactly, that we know that are good for us. So the part of the brain that knows that these things are good for us is our conscious or thinking brain, if you will. And this is the sort of more advanced, later developed prefrontal cortex. This is a part of the brain that imagines and creates and plans and sets the New Year's Eve goals.
Yeah, it's what makes us human.
Yes. However, when it comes to our behavior, most of our habitual patterns are dictated by the subconscious parts of our brain, the more emotional centers of our brain. This is where our habit loops reside.
This is what makes us mammals.
Yes, indeed. So when we think about our behaviors, there are certain limits to our willpower. There are certain limits to our conscious way of thinking. So even if I make a New Year's resolution, if I decide on New Year's Eve that I would like to adopt meditation as my new practice for stress management, day one, I wake up and I say, you know what, I'm going to meditate for 20 minutes in the morning each day. I do that day one, day two, maybe by day three, it's really cold outside and I'd rather keep sleeping and not wake up. That is a moment where I have sort of hit up against my limit of motivation and willpower. Or if there was another moment during my day when I was feeling really stressed out, I would encounter the same issue. What's happening there is that the subconscious brain then takes over. My habitual way of thinking takes over. And most of those decisions are guided very emotionally. So even without thinking about it, I will reach for, when I'm triggered, I will reach for that routine old behavior that's embedded in my circuits. So once we realize that a lot of our decision making is being run by these habitual patterns, that's the first step. Become aware and to become mindful that this is what's going on. It's also really important to not blame ourselves for it or to criticize ourselves for it. And to realize that changing behavior takes time. And it takes a lot of support. So the other aspect of behavior change is that it's really hard to do it alone. And this is one of the things that gets missed a lot, because I think even as physicians or in the healthcare system, we place so much importance on personal responsibility. And personal responsibility is, of course, key. But our environmental support, that is the people and the things that we surround ourselves with, have a much greater impact on our behavior. So when we think about the workplace and we think about, okay, how can we even begin to help folks at work be less stressed? We have to think about the systems that we're surrounding themselves with, whether it's the technology that you're using or the people that you surround yourselves with, or even joining a group of people who are on the same page as you in terms of adopting a new habit that you're trying to build. Those are very key aspects of behavior change that we need to think about when we're trying to make that new habit. And one last thing I'll say is that mindfulness and compassion are key players when it comes to designing or adopting new habits. They can be key allies for us. And again, this is something that most people are not aware of. But new research, especially the work of Judson Brewer and others, have shown that when we develop the capacity to lean into our experience, even when we're feeling discomfort, so when we're feeling stressed or when we're hitting up against the limits of our willpower, if we can just stay there and breathe and pause, then a wonderful thing happens. We notice that that craving or that discomfort or that urge usually passes away on its own. And we then have more than one option. We don't have just our knee-jerk option available, our routine behavior that's not so good for us. We realize, wait a minute, I can make a different choice in this moment.
Yeah, I think what's really dawning on me right now is I think the workplace is the new gym. You know, you think about what you do to stay healthy. It's like, oh, yeah, I go to the gym every day. And, you know, I'm thinking about how can I go to work in a way that's supportive of my health? I come from a place where, you know, work is work. I work so I can pay my bills and have a nice life and that sort of thing. But I really didn't understand the impact work has on my health.
So you remember that study I was talking about that Dr. Cole did on gene expression and in folks who were lonely? There was another study that he did, I think it was about 2014 or so, where he measured the levels of loneliness and social isolation in a group of folks. And then he also asked them about how connected they felt with meaning and purpose in their life. And guess what he found? He found that the folks who had meaning and purpose and who had the ability to volunteer and give back to the world in some way were protected from the effects of that altered gene expression that came from loneliness.
I want to pause you there because for a long time, and I have thought this is, oh, it's nice if you have work that's purposeful. Oh, it's a nice to have, it's for the lucky few to have work that is purpose-driven, or, you know, it's a millennial thing to want to find work that has purpose. And what you're saying is actually when you have this purpose-driven work, it's protective of your long-term health.
Exactly. And I also want to make sure that we're clear that, you know, meaning and purpose in life does not necessarily have to come from your day job. But if it can, all the more power to you. And, you know, for those folks out there who are saying, man, you know, there's no hope for me. It must be nice. You know, there's no way I can find a job like that. Well, take heart, because if there are other activities or other passions in your life where you can give back in meaningful ways, know that those are equally protective of your health.
You know, when people talk about wellness and HR benefits and the HR side of the house, it's always seen as discretionary or a nice to have. And you're really pointing at how it's meaningful for your health. It is meaningful for your long term. And so, like, don't necessarily wait until your company starts offering something. There are things you can do right now and you can be a leader. Can you talk a little bit about that?
As folks who are listening probably start to think about, okay, you know, I want to be healthier. Maybe they don't have that kind of support at the organizational level. One of the things that we know from compassion research is, again, just as I mentioned, it has a protective effect. So when we notice suffering, whether that's our own suffering or suffering in the people around us, and we are motivated in a warm and loving way to address that suffering and to take action to alleviate that suffering, it actually stimulates a part of our nervous system called the parasympathetic nervous system, which is the complete opposite of the fight or flight stress response sympathetic nervous system. So it's really cool. Our bodies are wired to help us calm down and reduce our stress when we help others. Isn't that amazing? So if we can start thinking about compassion in that sense, that, you know, when I reach out and help my colleagues in some way, that's actually good for my own health. That is one starting point. We also know that when folks are more compassionate within companies, and this is a lot of the research that Monica Warline and others have shown in organizational development, is that compassionate businesses have decreased absenteeism, decreased turnover, lower healthcare costs, but there's also greater levels of trust and collaboration and innovation in these companies. And one of the reasons they think this is happening is because these kinds of cultures nurture what's called psychological safety. Mm-hmm. So psychological safety is kind of a buzzword these days. It just simply means that teams have a level of trust and respect that allows them to be who they are at work. And they're able to take risks without feeling insecure or without sort of feeling that they're going to be punished. In fact, Google had recently done something called the Aristotle Project, and they looked at, I think it was about 180 different teams over 3 years, and they were really interested in finding out, okay, you know, what makes the best teams work? And they came up with a list of 5 factors, but number one was psychological safety. And so how do you build psychological safety within teams? And the answer that they came to was they boiled it down to 2 factors, empathy and compassion, and the ability to communicate well. And with our tools of mindfulness and compassion, we can achieve both. So as you're thinking about psychological safety or being more empathic or compassionate at work, I think as leaders at any stages of our lives, the first thing is to lead by example. So if I want to build more trust with my colleague, I need to take the first step of sharing something that might be a little personal or a little vulnerable with them. And when you do that, what happens is it sort of relaxes the other person. Because a lot of the times in the workplace, we run around sort of in this fight or flight mode, right? We're always on the defensive. But if we can start to share a little bit more about our personal lives, that actually relaxes our stress system and it starts to build that trust. The other thing that we can do is to help each other and to sort of move from this mindset of, you know, if something goes wrong, from a blame mindset of like, who did this, to like, what went wrong and how can we do that better the next time? And sort of adopting this mindset of learning from failure and letting it be a part of the process.
What I'm also hearing, I'm having flashbacks to just awful workplaces and awful bosses, and is just the responsibility that a manager or a leader has to create psychological safety. And it's one thing to expect, you know, someone who's an individual contributor or a leader of self to go out and try to seek this, but I want to really emphasize the responsibility managers and leaders have to create an environment like this, an environment that is high performance and psychologically safe. And I think one question that's coming up is, you know, at least in Silicon Valley, we're seeing a lot of new managers, a lot of people, you know, making that leap into management and feeling overwhelmed. Mm-hmm. You know, they're trying to come across as thoughtful and trustworthy to their superiors and that they deserve that promotion that they got. And now they have responsibility for people that were their peers maybe a month or two prior. Mm-hmm. And so what are some things that this person who is in a management position, however comfortable they feel with it, what are some things they can be thinking about to create that kind of safe environment that leads to the collaboration and innovation that everyone hopes to lead?
Yeah, that's a great question. One of the things they can do, again, sort of drawing from the research, Amy Cuddy has done some work around leaders and how they're perceived. And she says that, you know, there are two qualities that stand out when people assess how good a leader is. And one is their competence or strength, and the other is their warmth or trustworthiness. And she says that a lot of the times, especially, you know, if we've just been promoted or we're sort of being groomed to be the next leader, we often lead with our strength and our competence, thinking that that's what other people want to see. And what her research points to is the fact that if we do that, a lot of the times that actually ends up generating more fear amongst the people that you're working with, or they may close off to you. They might still do what you tell them to do, but it's going to put them again in that state of fight or flight. We have to remember we're social animals and we are wired to collaborate and work together. So for a new leader, they need to keep that in mind and lead with what Amy Cuddy suggests as well, which is lead with your warmth, lead with your trustworthiness. So the folks in your team, they need to feel that they can trust you. They need to know that the intentions that you have towards them are pure and good. So I would say for a new leader, just to first of all, remember that, to lead with warmth and love rather than your strength. And trust begets trust. So if you are willing to open up and meet individual folks in your team on a personal level and share something with them that they might not know otherwise about you, that will then set up this feedback loop. And by the way, biologically, this means that you're producing a little more oxytocin in your body, which helps to increase trust between people. And the other thing that they can do is to mindfully listen. So that mindful communication is a very important piece. And again, when it comes to team building, ultimately, what each one of us wants is to be felt that we are heard, that we're understood. And whether or not you're able to resolve a problem for your team member right off the bat, I think the fact that if you are willing to give them that space of feeling heard and understood will go a long way in building that trust. And the other cool thing, it's a very cool trick, is to use the word together. So I know it's very strange, but fascinating, is that in research, they've shown that when you give somebody a task and you say, let's do this together, versus just telling somebody to just go do a task, people feel more relaxed and more trustworthy, and they end up being more productive just by adding the word together.
Yeah. So I have a maybe controversial tangent to go off on.
Yes.
And, you know, you shared that You know, it's really about warmth and leading with warmth. And so much of the leadership development, the power conversation around women and people of color in the workplace really talks about the competency and how, you know, it's really about you have to work twice as hard, do twice as much to get half as far. That is a real experience for many people. And it is very confusing to say lead with your warmth when you're trying to show competence. It's not an either or, but I think, you know, you started to get there with it is about listening. It is about creating an experience of warmth. So you don't have to be everyone's best friend, but you can show up as a warm individual and human being. And so whatever identity that you may be holding doesn't have to stand in the way. You don't have to play into stereotypes, but there is a way that you can create an experience for people around you of warmth and openness, but also effectiveness and progress and that sort of thing. And you can do that together.
Absolutely. I think you've summarized that really well. Keep in mind, both strength and warmth are important. Those are the leaders that we admire most and look up to. And the other thing that's important to point out is that as you think about being this warm, compassionate leader, keep in mind that the essence of compassion is not kindness, it's courage. So compassion actually allows you to be the leader who, in those difficult times, has the capacity to hold all perspectives and hold all the views and the difficult emotions and then take the right step. And the right action might be something very firm or stern or not popular, and that's okay. Mm-hmm. That's a courageous and appropriate response. So just keep in mind that being warmth and caring does not mean always being kind or being a pushover.
Mm-hmm. I think that's a great distinction. It is about courage.
Yes.
And I think the work world being what it is, the things going on in the world, everyone is looking for courage now.
Yes, more than ever, especially with everything that's going on with our planet. Yeah, we need people to step up and make the ethical choice.
Mm-hmm. So what do you think would be some of the most courageous acts in the workplace towards one's health and towards their organization's health?
I'll start with folks' personal health. I think sleep is big. If there's one thing that you can do, I would say get an extra 15 minutes of sleep. That will go a long way. So start small, because I know it's hard for people to fit everything in. Of course, start a meditation and mindfulness practice for sure, or start a compassion practice for yourself. Again, you don't have to invest too much of your time. Start with a minute, 2 minutes, build it up. Small steps get you to your goal over time. And exercise is really important, of course. So move as much as you can throughout your day. Take the stairs at work. Park your car.
Take the lunch break.
Take the lunch break. Go out in nature, right? Commune with nature. Get the fresh air as much as possible. And I think also at work, if you can do all of these things with a colleague or with a small group, that adds to the probability of it lasting longer, but it just makes it more fun.
Yeah, and it's still very courageous.
It's still very courageous. But you're also, I think, sort of setting an example and sending a message that this matters. Your health matters. And of course, it's going to be reflected in your productivity and your creativity. That will definitely improve over time. And I think for an organization, this is where the decision makers and leaders really need to take a close, hard look at the long view for the organization and not just at the next quarter. And I know that's a very difficult thing to do. But if they're truly interested in employee well-being, the question to ask is, do we have the systems that enable our employees to do their best work? And if that's truly what they're looking for, then they will know that it's to their advantage to allow employees to have some flexibility around their working hours, for example, or working from home, and to have the resources, technology, for example, that will help them, whether it's a wearable that they use at work for fitness, whether it's access to mindfulness programs at work or access to healthier food at work. Mm-hmm. Those go a long way.
I have really enjoyed what we got into. I think what's clear for me now is that the workplace is part of your long-term health plan. And not just in the workplace often gives you benefits or gives you the money to buy health benefits, but creating that environment there that is supportive of the epigenetics and the expression of healthiness. So that's been super helpful. And then that compassion isn't necessarily just about kindness, it's about courage. And a lot of what we need to do for our health and for each other is taking a courageous step.
Exactly.
Thank you, Parneet.
Thank you, Meghna.
Hi, it's Corey, co-founder and CEO of Wisdom Labs. At Wisdom Labs, we're helping companies become wiser workplaces. To create this positive impact in organizations, we cultivate change at the level of the individual, team, and company culture. We see businesses as the biggest lever for positive social change at scale. After all, business still holds the most power and influence in our world. And as individuals, company cultures, and entire stakeholder networks become more wise, we all benefit. To learn more about Wisdom Labs, check out wisdomlabs.com. Thanks for listening.